The following Stealing the Mind of America presentation by Carrie Parks is entitled, How to Tell if Someone is Lying. For a complete audio and video teaching tape catalog, call Compass at 1-800-977-2177.
Tom DiBartolo was a 19-year decorated veteran of the Spokane Sheriff's Department. On the evening of November 2nd, 1996, DiBartolo went for a walk in the North Spokane Park with his wife, Patty. Patty didn't return from that walk. The 39-year-old mother of five children was shot execution style in the head. DiBartolo was shot in the side. Less than a week later, in my role as forensic artist for the Spokane Sheriff's Police Department, I interviewed DiBartolo to determine what the gunman looked like. Halfway through that interview, I knew he was lying. I knew that he had shot his own wife in the head and then shot himself in the side to disguise what had happened. Tonight, I'm going to share with you how you can determine when someone is lying to you. When Bill Perkins called me up to do this program, I was thrilled. This was a dream come true. I could not believe it. So I immediately turned to my Bible to get additional material. I didn't expect to find much about signs of deception in the Bible because deception is language and culturally based. But I was fascinated. I was overwhelmed. There were textbook examples. People were lying everywhere. Abraham was lying about Sarah, and we had Ananias and Sapphira, and you know what happened to them. And we had Cain that was lying to God. In fact, there were so many people lying in the Bible that I called Bill up and I said, Bill, I have got the perfect name for this talk. We'll call it, you ready? It's great. The Bible is full of lies. And Bill said no. He said, unless I wanted to deliver the entire program while ducking from tomatoes and eggs, that I probably should just stick to a regular kind of an introduction. Let me give you a little of my background before I go any further. As it was mentioned, I am a professional artist by background and training. I was the one that illustrated the Barb Peretti book, Seasons of My Heart, the story of Frank and Barb Peretti. And Frank and Barb are our best friends. In 1981, I went to work for the North Idaho Regional Crime Lab in Coeur d'Alene. The Regional Crime Lab handles physical evidence from the 10 northern counties of Idaho, the Department of Fish and Game, the ATF, the FBI, and any agency which requested our services. My initial duties were to prepare the trial charts to go to court. I'd like to say that I was hired because I was a phenomenal artist with a keen mind and an ability to solve crime like Sherlock Holmes, but actually my dad was the director of the crime lab. And he said I was the best artist he knew, but I think I was the only artist he knew. I'd like to present to you tonight what a variety of things about signs of deception. What does the Bible have to say about deception? I'd like to present to you some information about self-deception and about the three ways in which we understand perception. When I talk about deception, part of this comes from my training from the FBI. In 1985, I went to the FBI Academy in Quantico, Virginia, where I took a special two-week course on learning how to do composites. Now, a composite drawing is a drawing made up of the memory of a victim or witness of a crime. And it means that you have to, first of all, understand how to draw. Secondly, you have to understand how to interview. You have to know how the memory stores that information, and you have to know when people are lying to you. When I started doing this, immediately I was joined by my husband in 1988, and we started teaching this information across the nation to law enforcement agencies. And what I'm presenting to you tonight is what we teach law enforcement agencies to understand signs of deception. Starting with what the Bible says about lying. First of all, deceive, lying tongue, lying lips, lie, false witness are mentioned almost 200 times throughout the Bible. The ninth of the Ten Commandments warn you about being a false witness. Proverbs 6:16 says that two of the seven abominations of God are lying. Colossians 3:9 says that lying is expressly forbidden in the Christian community. Hosea 12:1 says that lying is an expression of evil. Proverbs 26:24 says that lying conceals hatred. Jeremiah 5:27 says that lying leads to pride and oppression. Revelation 21:27 says that all habitual liars forfeit eternal salvation. Jesus said in John 8:44 that Satan is the father of lies. And finally, it's summarized in Numbers 23:19 in that lying is incompatible with the divine nature of God. God cannot lie. There are textbook examples of lying and deception in the Bible. For instance, we know that lies are hard to remember. The lip of truth shall be established forever, but a lying tongue is but for a moment. Proverbs 12:19. Lies can use humor or sarcasm. Proverbs 26:19 said, as a madman who casteth firebrands, arrows, and death, so is the man that deceiveth his neighbors and saith, am I not in sport? Self-deception is fascinating, and the Bible covers self-deception very, very carefully. Self-deception is covered in Galatians 6:3, where it says, for if a man think himself to be something, when he is nothing, he deceives himself. James 1:26 says that if any man among you seems to be religious and bridles not his tongue, but deceiveth his own heart, this man's religion is in vain. There's a story that tells you about deception or self-deception in the Bible, and it comes from 2 Samuel 12. Now, most of you probably know this story. It's the story of David and Bathsheba. David had a little inappropriate contact with Bathsheba. And God told Nathan he needed to address this issue and to confront David with what he had done. Nathan told a story about two men. He told a story about a man who had everything. He had, I'm going to paraphrase this a little, okay? He had sheep, he had goats, he had these yards, he had a condo just up the street in Vale. He had everything. There was a second man who had nothing except a ewe, a female lamb. But he loved that lamb and he cared for it, took care of it every day. The very rich man had a party and which he decided instead of using his own sheep to serve for dinner, he would serve the poor man's lamb. And that's what he did. When David heard this story, he was outraged. And he said, as the Lord liveth, the man that hath done this thing shall surely die, and he shall restore the lamb fourfold, because he did this thing, because he had no pity. And Nathan said to him, thou art the man. This gives you some idea of self-deception. It is absolute, and you don't know it's happening, even when you're doing it. The Bible goes on and talks about self-deception. In James 1:22, it gives an analogy about self-deception, and it uses a fascinating analogy. But ye be doers of the word, and not hearers only, deceiving your own selves. For if any be a hearer of the word, and not a doer, he is likened to a man beholding his natural face in a glass. For he beholds himself, and goeth his way, and straightway forgetteth what manner of man he was. Now, Matthew Henry, when he talked about this, and other Bible scholars, said that when you look into a mirror and you walk away, what happens is when you're looking at the mirror, you see all the spots and all the faults, all that's wrong, and when you walk away, you forget what you see. Self-deception, therefore, according to the Bible and Bible scholars, is a matter of memory, remembering what you saw. But I would like to pass on and share with you a little bit deeper insight into this passage. This insight comes from teaching people to look into a mirror and to draw their face. As a composite artist, I teach people to look and to draw what they see. If I ask you to pull out a mirror, this is an awesome thing. I almost did this. We went through a lot. If I ask you to pull out a mirror right now, look at your face, look at your face, and then leave the room and draw your face, chances are, unless you are a portrait artist, you would not be able to do it. In fact, if I said, pull out a mirror, take out a pencil and paper, and draw your own face right now, you couldn't do it, even if it's in front of you. Chances are, in fact, that your drawing would resemble that of Taylor Perkins, who's 7 years old. And actually, some of you are going, hey, you know, that kid's pretty good. Why can't you draw your face? It's because seeing your face is not just a fault of memory, it's a fault of perception. The Greek word for beholding, as in beholding your face in a mirror, is to perceive. So all the information you have is in front of you. You can't see it. You are incapable of seeing it. Like David, when Nathan told the story, he was incapable of seeing what was in front of him. Why is this? It has to do with the way the mind perceives and recognizes and stores information. When you went to school, you learned that this particular shape was the letter A. It had a sound, A or ah. You memorized that shape and put it in your mind and forgot about it. From then on, no matter what shape you saw the letter A, it always meant A or ah. You do that with all incoming information. Everything comes into your mind, you put it into a pattern of perception, and then you forget about looking at it. Perception, therefore, can be defined in three different ways. Perceptions are a filter by which you see the world. You don't see the world around you the way it really is. You see it the way you perceive it to be. Perceptions are powerful. They are so powerful that they will prevent you from seeing your own face in a mirror, or from seeing the things in front of you, or from seeing self-deception. And finally, perceptions do not change unless a significant event happens. We're going to give you a significant event tonight. When Taylor Perkins did this drawing, she did it based on the perceptions of memorized patterns that she received at the age of 7. You have the same memorized patterns. So where did they come from? Well, starting with the eyes, of course, you are a television generation, so when you went to draw your eyes, your inspiration came from CBS. When you went to draw your nose, now most people would draw a nose kind of a loopy thing here, but probably the great majority do some form of a triangular shaped nose, or my particular favorite is when you put the pig snout option right there in the middle. That's because once a year you probably carved that triangular nose into a pumpkin. When it came to do the math, of course, we are a group of have a nice day people. So we drew the little line. Some of you might have even acknowledged you do have upper and lower lips. Let me go back and make those three important points. When you look at your face in a mirror and walk away, all you remember is the previously remembered patterns as symbols by which represent your face, not the true features of your face. But there is more insight into this passage in James. Though we look at our face and can't draw it, it's not a permanent condition. You can learn to draw and see your face by using tools, tools to break through perceptual patterns. For instance, Taylor Perkins, upon learning tools, I don't know how well that shows up, was able to do this drawing after just learning a few tools. Artists have various techniques and tools by which we can learn to see and draw the world around us. Those help us break through our perceptual patterns, and those same tools of a different type will help you with your self-deception. Once again, self-deception is powerful. It prevents you from seeing the things in front of you. Perception and self-deception are not a problem necessarily just of memory, but of your perception of the world around you. And finally, your perceptions and your self-deception can be overcome. With drawing, we have drawing tools that in a very short amount of time will teach you how to see the world in front of you. The Bible tells you you have the same tools. In John 16:13, it says in self-deception, "Howbeit that when he, the Spirit of truth, is come, he will guide you into all truth." In other words, the indwelling Holy Spirit is your guide, your tool. That's what you need to help you with self-deception. Moving into how can you tell if someone is lying. Now, I know yesterday and today you have been told repeatedly that either a politician and or Bill Clinton, you can tell he's lying because his lips are moving.
That's a lie.
There's actually three ways. You can tell he's lying because of writing, because of nonverbal clues, and of course through verbal clues. We're going to start with written clues to deception. I'm going to ruin your life now. I'll give you some warnings first. You're all going to be staring at each other from this and all, you know, going, I wonder what he means when he did that. Yeah. I have a number of warnings to give to you. The examples I'm going to present are just examples. I am not saying that this person at this time, this is absolutely a lie. It is just an example that just happens to resemble very strongly a lie. I don't mean to make you 55-minute experts. In this amount of time, what I'm trying to do is to give you warning bells. So when you hear or see any of these actions occurring, and you understand what they mean, that a warning bell will go off in your mind, and you will say, wait a minute, whoa, let's back up and take another look at that. The clues I'm giving you, the examples I'm giving you, are culturally based, and they are based on the North American white average culture. Native Americans it won't work for. People from other cultures this will not work for, because they have different cultures. This is not universal. Before you can determine if anyone is lying to you or telling the truth, you have to first understand what that person is like before anything happens. In other words, you have to establish a baseline. They call this norming, or another way, you could call it, I'm discovering the truth of the individual. The best way of doing this is just sitting down and talking with them, or listening to them without any kind of stress going on. There is no universal lie clue. There is no one single thing that a person can do that tells you absolutely that they're lying. Now, I will say, I was corrected 2 weeks ago when I taught a law enforcement class in New Hampshire. They said that there was a universal lie clue. If your pants catch on fire, as in liar, liar, pants on fire, that is a universal clue. So outside of spontaneous trouser combustion, there is no other universal lie clue. Lying clues occur in cluster behavior. That's why I say there's no single clue. You're looking for three or more clues, three or more things. They could be verbal or nonverbal or a combination. But no one thing has any one meaning. Therefore, it's okay, you guys in the front row. You can scratch your nose now. You're okay. No one clue. Lying is stressful. Therefore, lying and stress and deception all look very, very much alike. That's why I want to say use warning bells only. Don't think that just because somebody does something, it may be because they're very stressed. So understand, that's why they're warning bells. What we're looking for is something in response to stimuli. The best way you can tell a sign of deception usually is in some kind of an interview situation where there's a question and answer situation. That is, somebody asks a question, there's an answer to it. When you've got a prepared speech, understand, particularly when you get into higher politicians, the people that train me, the FBI, people I train the FBI, are also training them. So they're going to go through and teach them all these things not to do. They still give themselves away, but usually the best way to determine is through some kind of an interview situation. The clue should be consistent. That is, every time the same question is asked, you should get the same kind of consistent response. It should be timely. You've got 3 to 5 seconds to give that response, either verbal or nonverbal response. It should be within 3 to 5 seconds. And finally, some people are just plain good liars. We're going to start with written clues to deception. The pronoun we. The pronoun we means that there is a relationship, a togetherness. When you use the pronoun we, it means you and that person are together. If I were interviewing a victim or witness of a crime, and that my victim or witness said to me, I walked out to my car, and this man grabbed me, and he threw me in the car, and he made me drive up the street, that would sound truthful. That is truthful. If my witness said, or my victim said, I saw a man in the driveway, he grabbed me, he threw me in the car, and we drove up the street, I would worry. A warning bell would go off. Why are we? We should not be we. We should be separate. There should not be a togetherness in the word they use. Now here's an example, therefore, of a relationship being described. And I agreed. And I met him back there. We went back to his office again in the back study area. So Monica Lewinsky in her grand jury testimony is indicating that there is a relationship at this point. Nouns are very important. A change of language indicates a change of the circumstance, the change of the situation. If a person uses one word consistently as they're speaking, and all of a sudden they change that word, you want to pay attention to where they've changed that word. That means that at that point, that particular circumstance has changed. This example is from the NBC Today show with Matt Lauer in January of 1998. And the question was asked, has he, meaning President Clinton, described to you what the nature of Monica Lewinsky's relationship was? And Hillary Clinton answered, "But I think the important thing now is to stand as firmly as I can and say that, you know, the president has denied these allegations on all counts unequivocally, and we'll see how this plays out." Now, what makes this very significant is that prior to this, she had referred to Clinton 18 times as my husband. The only time she referred to him as the president was when this question was asked. This indicates a separation, a change of circumstance has occurred. Verbs are another way in which you can determine something. Susan Smith, and Susan Smith, if you remember, is the young mother in Union, South Carolina, who killed her two children by driving them in the car into the water. Susan Smith, in every interview and every time she spoke to the press, referred to her children in the past tense. "My children wanted me, they needed me, and now I can't help them." Contrast that with David Smith, her husband, who immediately said, "They're okay, they're going to be home soon." Susan knew her children were dead. So therefore, without knowing it, she always referred to them in the past tense. David believed them to be alive, and therefore they were always in the present tense for him. An additional verb use comes from a very fascinating source. O.J. Simpson wrote a suicide note. Why he called it a suicide note, I don't know. He only said he was going to go away. In this note, which was a handwritten note, he handwrote it and he gave it to a reporter. The reporter kind of cleaned it up and it was published in the paper. The opening sentence of this note said, "First, everyone understand I have nothing to do with Nicole's murder." That's an incorrect verb use. It means a distancing from what happened. But what's even more fascinating is when you went back to the original note, the original handwritten note, O.J. had taken and crossed out the words, "I have," so that the note should have read, "First, everyone understand nothing to do with Nicole's murder." The final version was not a denial. The actual words used are very significant. Michael Jackson wrote a long disclaimer about what he didn't do with a young man. And in that note, he used the terms, "I am innocent." The specific example here is, "Don't treat me like I'm a criminal because I am innocent." Understand that somebody saying, "I am innocent," does not mean they're saying, "I didn't do it." You can feel that you are innocent and still be guilty of whatever it is. Another source comes from a fascinating bit of reading I did, adding up the number. This comes from the Book of Mormon. All right, I'm going to make a confession here. I didn't read the Book of Mormon. I got one of those computer things where you can do a little cross-reference, so I just kind of dialed a few things and got a couple of examples, so I thought you'd like this. Alma 2:19 tells about, let me back up a little bit here. If I were interviewing somebody and that person is lying to me, for instance, and they want to make up something and then making up involves numbers, it's always easier to make up numbers that are multiples of each other. "Oh, well, I held 3 jobs for the last 6 years, of which I got 12 pay raises." Okay, multiples. Always there's something you want to sit back and take a second look at. In this area of the Book of Mormon, we have a battle going on. And it came to pass that the Nephilites did pursue the Amalekites that day and did slay them with much slaughter. Insomuch that there were slain of the Amalekites 12,530 and 2 souls, and there were slain of the Nephilites 6,560 and 2 souls. What a fascinating battle. Multiple of the numbers. Now, I can use the Book of Mormon because the Book of Mormon makes a number of statements. In Mormon 8:5, it states that the Book of Mormon was written by a man. "Behold, my father has made this record." In Mormon 8:17, it says, "And if there be faults, they be the faults of a man." Or in other words, the Book of Mormon was written by a man and it's full of faults. Additionally, "And whosoever receiveth this record and shall not condemn it, because of the imperfections which are in it," Mormon 8:12, which I call Freudian slips. Lack of conviction. In 1 Nephi 1:8, we'll stay with the Book of Mormon, I got a lot of material there. It said, "And being thus overcome with the Spirit, he was carried away in a vision, even that he saw the heavens open, and he thought he saw God." He thought he saw God. There's a lot of people that you can see. Let's contrast that, shall we say, with what what the Bible says. The Bible, in the book of Revelation, John saw a lot of things. Never once did John say, "I thought I saw." He always said, "I saw. I saw this. I saw that." He never thought he saw anything. Again, additional lack of conviction. Now, if somebody pulled a gun on me and, you know, held it in front of me, I would have said, "The guy had a gun on me." I wouldn't have said, "I think he had a gun on me." In 1 Nephi 8:3 in the Book of Mormon, it made this statement, "I have reason to rejoice in the Lord because of Nephi and also of Sam. For I have reason to suppose that they and also many of their seed will be saved." That's a frightening salvation statement. I have reason to suppose. Let's contrast that with Job 19:25, who says, "For I know that my Redeemer liveth, and he shall stand on the latter day upon this earth." Or how about 2 Timothy 1:12, "For I know whom I have believed, and I am persuaded that he is able to keep that which I have committed to him against that day." "For I know" statements occur 16 times in the Book of Mormon. Never once does it say, "For I know my Redeemer." Again, additional lack of conviction, 1 Nephi 8:4, Book of Mormon. "But behold, Laman and Lemuel, for I fear exceedingly because of you. For behold, methought I saw in my dream a dark and dreary wilderness." We'll contrast his dreams with Daniel 2:41, where Daniel relays what the king's vision were. And we had the whole book of Daniel here, where he said, he thought the king thought he might have seen this because he thought he saw it in a dream. He said, no, this is what you saw. Cornelius' vision in Acts 10:3 said he saw in a vision an angel of God. Acts 26:13, Paul describes what he saw on the road to Damascus. All of their statements have absolute conviction in them. They don't think they saw anything. They don't have reason to suppose. They know. They believe. There's absolute conviction. Blame someone else. Universal blame. We're going to go back to the book, Holy Book, the Bible, Genesis 3:12. Now, this is good because there's not a lot of people around for Adam to blame, but he did pretty good. And the man said, "The woman whom thou gave to be with me," he's got two now, "she gave," he's blamed Eve twice now. Isn't that typical male? "She gave it to me," okay, "and I did eat." So you see, the confession is the very last thing, but he's already blamed God once and Eve twice. Universal, spread it around. A mistake or Freudian slip. A brand new magazine came out last month called Talk Magazine. And in Talk Magazine, there was an interview with Hillary Clinton that was fascinating. In fact, it made big, big news because they went on and on about the fact that Hillary was talking about how he had some problems and his grandmother and his mother fought and all kinds of things like that. But I thought they missed really one of the most significant things in that whole article. On page 174, it said, "And you know," this is Hillary speaking, "and you know we really did have a very good stretch," she adds later, referring to the period after Jennifer Flowers, "years and years of nothing." Isn't that a sad way to describe your marriage? Nonverbal clues to deception. The nonverbal clues to deception occur in many places in the Bible where it is literally described. And this is so amazing because, as I mentioned, because it's cultural and language, I didn't expect to find this. But in Proverbs 28:1, it said, "The wicked flee where no man pursueth, but the righteous are as bold as iron." Now, that's fascinating. This is a textbook example of the what's called the launch position when you're sitting in a chair. I'll demonstrate in just a few minutes. And a second example is, "He winketh with his eyes, he speaketh with his feet, he teaches with his fingers." Three areas where you get nonverbal signs of deception. Let's go through some nonverbal signs. I've got to move out here a little bit. Is there no light over there? Nonverbal signs of deception. I'm going to start with the top of my head and work my way down, just to give you a lot of... You guys won't be able to see if I do it, though, will you? Well, I'll move. I'll just keep moving. How's that? Nonverbal signs. Starting with the top of your head, like this. This is going to make you so... I saw that. It's going to make you so self-conscious, you won't be able to move. When you itch the top of your head, it means your head itches. It could mean head lice. Actually,
usually what you're looking for here, this is a start of what's called self-grooming behavior. And it gets into the hair, and then you can work your way into ear cleaning there. You can check for the dog hairs on your clothing, examine your nails, all kinds of things like that. It's called self-grooming behavior. There's three different times you're going to do self-grooming behavior. The first is when you're alone, and you're driving in your car, and you look in the mirror to see if you got green stuff on your teeth, you know. The second is when you're with friends that you're comfortable with. You know, you feel it's okay. You know, you can sit there, you can comb your hair, do your nails. The third is when you are under stress, which occurs when you are lying. So be watching for self-grooming behavior in response to a stimulus within 3 to 5 seconds of that occurring. You get into the eyebrow areas. Eyebrows are good for that who me. Who me? When you get to the eyes are very good because we use the eyes to break eye contact. Now, I'm going to come back to that in just a minute. Breaking of eye contact can be looking around for an answer. It can be, I'm going to think about that one for just a minute. You can look over to the side over here. You can start in on the self-grooming behavior here. You can close your eyes. You can blink rapidly. Any kind of break of eye contact. Now, people who know that do the reverse of that, and you can tell from this. That's this look. They pin you with your eyes. So that also means something as well. Now, the ears are good. As I mentioned, you can relieve a lot of stress with your ears. The nose is real good for relieving stress. Up to and including inappropriate, socially acceptable nose behavior. We use our mouth a lot of different ways. One thing we can do, we can lick our lips. See, when you're about to tell a whopper, your mouth starts to dry out. So you got to lick your lips there and get them going there. Is the spit's all gone? Because you gotta start getting that spit going there. Your mouth starts working. If you're a guy, you got the Adam's apple starts to wiggle about this point. You can roll your mouth, bite your lips, cover your mouth. Any way you cover your mouth. Anybody that's sitting out there that's covering their mouth, it means you don't want to hear anything about what I'm saying. So covering of the mouth, any kind of mouth behavior. Now I'm going to come back to eye behavior or hand behavior, but I realize the idea of actually using a chair on this stage, after Frank Peretti and all that stuff, I'm not going to do the Peretti chicken walk. That's all I can tell you. For most of you, you've learned probably, you know, body language 101 teaches that when you sit in a chair like this, that's called crossing behavior. And they say when a person is sitting like that, this is great significance. This person is closed off. They're not open to any ideas. Actually, it just means you're sitting there with your arms and legs crossed. Remember, there's no universal lie clue. It has absolutely no meaning. None. Whatsoever. Unless it is in response to a stimulus. So if a person is sitting there very comfortably, and all of a sudden I ask them a question like, where were you last night? And they go, let me think about this. That would be more significant. Any kind of leaning behavior while in the chair, leaning towards the door, kicking the feet. I did mention the launch position. That's, you gotta get your feet back here. You gotta get right on the edge of your seat. You're ready to launch out of that chair. That's the one that's described in the Bible. You're gonna wicked flee there. Now there are three different hand motions that I want you to be very aware of. Because they're very significant. Well, let me cover three others before I get into that. Pointing. It's very difficult to point at somebody if you're going to lie to them. It's hard to point this way and it's hard to point that way. You can point inward, but it's difficult to point outward. If you do point, the pointing is going first before the words come out. A genuine pointing, the timing has to be on. If you've accused me of something, I'm going to point first. Listen, I didn't do it. This is false. Listen. I didn't do it. The pointing's got to come first. The hand motion comes first. The hand motion leads the statement. It doesn't come later. The motions always come first. And barriers, building barriers. If you're sitting there talking with someone and you notice they're all of a sudden they're arranging their dinner plate and all the food between you and them, it means they're trying to build a barrier between the two of you. Now, I mentioned there are three hand motions I want you to be very aware of. The first one is this one. Your hand forms an L like this. No, it's not loser or liberal. It starts like this, goes under the chin like this, and it's cupping like this. This can indicate a sign of suppressed rage. The second one is reaching back and rubbing or squeezing the neck. This can indicate suppressed violence. And the third one is called steepling. It's like this, or it's like this, or it's two finger, or it's under the chin. Steepling behavior is a sign when somebody steeples you that they feel that they are absolutely superior to you in every way. And when they steeple you in front of their mouth, not only are they superior to you, they're not going to tell you. Moving on to verbal. Just remember, the next time they steeple you, just give them one of these right back again. Verbal clues to deception. Voice pitch. If I'm talking along like this, and I'm doing okay, and you ask me a question, and all of a sudden my voice goes, and I start going way down here, and I've done all kinds of trouble with my voice, unless you're Frank Peretti. If your voice pitch starts going up and down like that, that would be a warning bell. You'd want to pay attention to that. Your voice volume. What happens when you start to lie is that you start to lose your breath. And so you got to take a big breath because a whopper's going to come out next, but the breath comes out too fast and your voice drops. When you come out, it comes out like this. So you have to take another deep breath and it's going to come right back out again. And so the volume is going to go up and down. The rate of speech. If you ask me something where I've already memorized the lie, I will tell it to you very fast because after all, I've memorized it and I know exactly how it's going to go. So I'm going to go through it very quickly because after all, if I don't do it right fast, I'll forget it. But if you ask me something that I haven't really thought about, it's going to take me a bit to think of the answer. So my rate will change. Speech dysfunction. When speech dysfunction occurs, it often will indicate up to a 90% probability of deception. Now, this is not a person who normally has a speech dysfunction. This is a person who's talking along quite normally. A question is asked, and all of a sudden you get this, blah, 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 you know, the mouth just goes crazy. A perfect example of speech dysfunction looks like this. Well, I don't know if I would... Maybe that's what she said I should have. I don't remember. I'm sorry. I won't deny calling her. Now, this particular speech dysfunction came right after the question of the grand jury on Kathleen Wiley. Did he call her? And what was significant was that he was speaking quite normally up until that point. Another example of speech dysfunction is a fascinating example. It just came out. On June 15th of 1999, Monique Brown, who is the wife of NFL Hall of Famer Jim Brown, called 911 to say that she was terrified for her life. Apparently, Jim Brown was beating the windows in of her car and, come and help her type of thing. On August 4th of this year, Monique Brown, Jim Brown, Larry King, and Jim Brown's attorney all appeared on Larry King Live to do an interview that would show that Jim Brown did not feel that that constituted violence, domestic violence. The question was asked of Monique Brown, what were you fearing during that phone call? Now, she had been speaking in a normal tone of voice. According to the interview, her words had been flowing and so on. And the way she answered that was, I was fearing he was going to leave, and I wasn't, and he was some. In my mind, that was the reality at that point, that he was going to leave town, and I was fearing the end of our marriage, and I was, yes. Additional verbal clues. I can't. I can't is a literal admission that they're unable to tell you something. So you can say, I can't really say. Well, I couldn't really say about that. I'm not really able to say that. I couldn't say, I can't really couldn't tell you. I can't really say that. Hard question. That's a hard question. That's a toughie. That's a good question. And I'm glad you asked that question. But I can't really say. What was the question? Oh, by the way. Oftentimes an oh, by the way precedes what they really want to know. Oh, by the way, did you hear from your previous boss? Oh, by the way, have you caught that guy yet? Oh, by the, whenever somebody says, oh, by the way, pay very close attention to what they're asking, because oftentimes that's what they really want to know. I can honestly say this. I can truthfully tell you this. Well, if they're now truthfully telling me this now, what did they say before? I can honestly say always makes me sit up straighter. Multiple denials. No, 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 no. Monica Lewinsky, question. And that's not listed as an intimate encounter? No, 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 it's not, no, it's not. Additional multiple denials. O.J. Simpson, ESPN Up Close with Chris Myers. Question. All right. Are you in denial? Absolutely not. Not at all. Nope. Nope. Not at all. No. Nope. Nope. Unfinished business. Unfinished business is the implication that there is additional information that you're not going to hear. They're going to tell you a part of that information. In Bill Clinton's apology to the American public, he says, I can only tell you I was motivated by many factors. No kidding. First, by a desire to protect myself from the embarrassment of my own conduct. I can only tell you this. This is all I'm going to tell you. Is this all? No. This is all I'm going to tell you. But I told the grand jury today, and I say to you now, this is what I'm going to say to you now. Is this everything? No. That at no time did I ask anyone to lie, to hide or destroy evidence, or to take any other unlawful action. Okay. Additional verbal clues. Significant pause. I like this one. Because see, when you're about to tell a whopper, you got to think of the lie first. So it's going to take you a minute. So you say, were you out late last night? No, 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 no. You can fill that in with sound effects. Were you out late last night? Oh. Wait. For those of you parents, the teenage version is. Emotion. Deception is not an emotion. But deception can be hidden with emotion. The easiest emotion to use is anger. Now, if someone accuses you of something and you didn't do it, that will make you angry. And you will respond, as I said, with the usual angry clues and so on. If you are suspicious that they are using anger or another emotion to hide it, if you are angry, you don't become unangry quickly. You are angry, and you will stay angry for a little bit. What you want to do is follow up that question with another question that is meant to be light, like a joke even. If you're really angry, you're going to go, I don't think this is funny. That's not funny. I don't see any humor in that. If, however, you're using that emotion as a cover-up, you might go, ha, yeah. It's one way in which you can determine whether a person is being deceptive with you. Answer a question with a question. Genesis 4:9, I love this one. And the Lord said unto Cain, where is Abel thy brother? And he said, I know not, am I my brother's keeper? Actually, you know, I think that they just didn't get the translation. I think what he said was, am I my brother's keeper? Kids would give you that. Why are you always asking me? Why don't you ever trust me? Why do you think I did it? Huh? Implied answer is no answer. This is a press conference between reporter Helen Thomas and President Nixon's press secretary, Ronald Ziegler, during Watergate. The question was asked, has the president asked for any resignations so far, and have any been submitted to your desk? Ziegler answered, I have repeatedly stated, Helen, that there is no change in the status of the White House staff. Now, what's very good is that Helen Thomas immediately called him on that. Thomas asked, but that was not the question. Has he asked for any resignations? And the answer is, catch the time to think on this one. Ziegler, I understand the question, and I heard it the first time. Let me go through my answer. As I have said, there is no change in the status of the White House staff. There have been no resignations submitted. That question still is unanswered. The answer does not equal the question. This is from a Time magazine interview with Bill Clinton. I'm sorry about all the examples from Clinton. I tried to find other sources, but it was such rich material. He fit every category. April 13th, 1997. The question was asked of Time magazine, what is the legal justification for invoking executive privilege not only for yourself, but also for your wife? It will delay the Starr investigation. Answer, I think you have to ask my counsel's office, because the first time I learn about a lot of these legal arguments is when I see them in the papers. That is not an answer. No answer following that. Time magazine asks, how can that be? I love this. I'm just not going to talk about it. The answer does not equal the question. A second example from a 1993 White House briefing on Vince Foster's death. Now, this whole interview had so many parts to it that I could have used, but I liked this part the best. The question was asked, has his office, meaning Vince Foster's, office been searched at all for clues, and is it now being sealed as part of the investigation? And the answer is, it's secured. Yes, it's secured. Yeah, but has it been searched? And has it been sealed? So we got a partial answer with the next one. What particular official made the ruling that the death was by suicide, and what particular official was conducting the autopsy? Answer, the Fairfax County Coroner's Office in the instance of the latter question, and the Park Service police report indicated that. He only answered the second part of the question. Verbal garbage. This is a question of Mrs. Ramsey. Mrs. Ramsey is the mother of Jovenet Ramsey. They asked her a question. You found the note. Was it a handwritten note, 3 pages? Generally speaking, people will give you verbal garbage or rambling answers when they're either under a great deal of stress or when they're being deceptive. If you notice where the location of the 3 pages, that's the red up there, that is her answer. All the rest of that was verbal garbage that she rattled on and on and on and on and on. Memory problems. Had a lot of memory problems. Question. What, if anything, did Monica Lewinsky say in response? Answer. Nothing that I can remember. Whatever she said, I don't remember. That's actually 2 denials. Probably just some predictable thing. Then you can put it all together, kind of the grand slam of all types of things. The O.J. Simpson interview on ESPN up close. Question was, did you use drugs? Answer, I, in my life, yeah, I think, I experimented with drugs. So we've got a problem with the continuity there. He's got a memory problem that just kicked in. It's not a straightforward answer. But I love his second answer. Were you at the time of the murders? Were you using drugs at the time of the murders? No, no, no. Once I started playing golf in the late 80s or so, you know, I'm a guy that goes to bed at 8 o'clock and gets up, laughs early, and go play golf. Mark Twain said, when in doubt, tell the truth. It will confound your enemies and astound your friends. This afternoon, I've shared with you what the Bible had to say about deception, about self-deception, and I've given you a number of clues for deception. A Christian's response to deception occurs in Genesis 3 with the first lie. The first question the serpent asked of Eve in the garden was important. Has God indeed said, you shall not eat of everything in the garden? This is critical for the exchange that follows. Remember that in order for a lie to be detected, you first have to understand the baseline or the truth of what's happening. We know that Eve knew the truth because she repeated it back. Then came the lie. Now figure, how many lies had Eve had prior to that time? Figure, even the most common lie a husband gives to a wife was not in the garden. You know that one, don't you? Sweetheart, do you think it's apple that makes me look fat?
Why, no, dear. You look wonderful.
Eve hadn't even had that lie. But she did know the truth. And God held her accountable for knowing the truth. God holds us accountable for knowing the truth. When I started this program, I told you the story of Tom DiBartolo. And I told you how I knew he was lying. I knew he was lying not from anything that I told you in this speech. I knew he was lying because I know the truth of how a witness should respond. The average witness to a crime can only remember 5 facial features. If they remember any more than 5, they always tell me why they remember additional features. I'll never forget that face, that it's ingrained in my mind. I could draw it overnight, just whatever. They always have a disclaimer. DiBartolo described a man who he saw as the headlight flashed across his face on a dark night, and he described the head shape, the hairline, the forehead, the eyebrows, the eyes, the nose, the lips, the chin, the cheekbones, the skin tone, the ears, and the collar of the man he saw in that amount of time. I knew what he should have remembered. I knew the truth, and therefore I knew he was lying. As Christians, we are accountable for knowing the truth. There is no way we can stand against the enemy without the truth. Ephesians 6:12 tells us, "For we wrestle not against flesh and blood, but against principalities, against powers, against the rulers of the darkness of this world, against spiritual wickedness in high places." And John 8:44 says, Jesus says, "He was a murderer from the beginning," referring to Satan, the enemy, "and abode not in the truth, because there is no truth in him. When he speaketh a lie, he speaketh his own, for he is a liar and the father of it." In other words, Satan is absolutely consistent with deception. You will not know his lie. You will only know the truth. I have a prayer, a hope, and a promise for you today. I pray that if you do not yet know God's truth, you'll find it here today. I hope that you will discover at least one gem of information that you'll be able to take and use with you after this conference. And I promise, I will never, ever, ever steeple you.
If you'd like information about purchasing this presentation on videotape, or for a tape catalog of all of the Stealing the Mind of America audio or videotapes, or for future conference information, call Compass at 1-800-977-2177. Or you can write to Compass at 460 Canfield Avenue, Suite 1000, Coeur d'Alene, Idaho, 83815.